session number 17894, reel 3.
Andy Seft on reel 2. Continue, please.
So we're now sitting on the runway. The ground crew have been waved away. We're moving forward slowly because we've got 800 RPM. And the levers are set at the idle position. The left-hand lever is then smoothly brought to the position noted during the pre-flight run-up. The right-hand lever ditto, but if we move the right-hand lever first, we'll get a rich cut and we'll stop. But we get the engine back online, we check the RPM, and we're now moving down the runway. The next thing we must do is lean the mixture slightly, i.e. move the right-hand lever back, because as we accelerate down the runway, the revs increase, which enriches the mixture through centrifugal force, and if we do nothing about it, then we'll almost certainly get a rich cut on takeoff and the engine will stop. So as we're moving down the runway, the right-hand lever is brought back slightly, which is the first non-intuitive thing on a rotary, because it really means you're moving the levers back as you're taking off, whereas intuitively you want to move them forward. Once we're airborne, it's a matter of adjusting the right-hand lever to maintain smooth running of the engine. As you climb, it needs to be lean because the air is getting thinner. As we accelerate, it needs to be lean because of the centrifugal enrichment, and as we slow down or descend, the opposite occurs. There's an interesting note in the book for the Lerone, 110 horsepower Lerone engine, where it says that when climbing, the mixture needs to be leaned off. When descending, the best way to descend is to shut the engine down using the petrol lever. If we descend using the blip switch and cut the ignition, we're still putting fuel in oil. It's a total loss oil system. And oil runs through the engine all the time. And if we shut the ignition, oil and fuel are still going into the engine. When we release the ignition blip switch, it's a fair bet that the cylinders are full of oil and petrol, and the plugs are oiled and petrolled up, and they ain't going to work. So the best way to descend it is to turn the fuel off and leave the ignition on. So if anything does get onto the plugs, one hopes that it'll burn it off, and you're minimising the amount of fuel that's going into the engine. It says for descent, you should descend by turning the engine off using the fuel lever, and when you pass the altitude 300 feet above that which you wish to level, you set the levers to the position that you noted on the climb. So it means, really, that these First World War pilots had to have a mental note of the lever positions at all stages of flight, which I find quite interesting.
Now, this goes on to a question I'm asking you. I mean, this whole ritual had to be gone through at 6 o'clock on a muddy aerodrome in France before the dawn patrol.
That is what everybody says, and you're absolutely right. But when we send our Harriers off to war in the Gulf, then they go through about a half-hour ritual of checking their electronics and everything else, and it's really just equivalent. In those days, the skill of piloting was keeping the airplane and the engine operating. Nowadays, the skill of piloting is learning how to work the video game that you've got sitting in the cockpit with your electronic warfare sensors, your jamming pods, your chaff dispenser, your flare dispenser, your suite of weapons, your laser markers, forward-looking infrared, night vision goggles, and
yes,
organising all of those.
But for you to be sitting in an ejector seat doing all this means that you are highly qualified and highly selected. You look at these First World War guys who have probably just got off their cavalry horse a few weeks before, and they're put into a cockpit of one of these things and have to take them off and go and fight in them.
They've learned to fly. They've done a short flying course. I don't think anybody went to war with less than about 50 hours under their belt.
Yeah, those that survived the training course.
Yeah, those that survived the training. Yeah. Well, training's a different thing, yes.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right in what you say, and to us it's quite incredible that they could go to war like that. But there is two aspects of it. One, they were trained to do that and they didn't know anything else. And two, that was the engine of the day. All engines were like that. the motorbikes and the cars had advance and retards and mixture controls and just about everything else. So
but they weren't all fed from the crankshaft.
No, they weren't. But
you know, you had the Bristol fighter engine. What was it? It was a Rolls Royce Eagle, was it? Liquid cooled.
Falcon. Yeah, it's liquid cooled, but again, on that aeroplane, the management of the air system to keep the tanks pressurised and management of the cooling system to keep the engine at the right temperature is almost equivalent to keeping a rotary gang.
Really?
Once you've got the skill, I mean, I've laid it on a little bit thick, obviously, to give a good description of the beast, but once you have the skill, it becomes intuitive. And there's just two levers, and you shuffle them around with your left hand, and you listen to the engine with your ear, and you watch the RPM out of the corner of your eye, and it all works. But when I'm teaching somebody how to fly that type of airplane, that is the sort of description I go through.
This has been absolutely invaluable, because I have always had at the back of my mind that rotaries were very crude engines. They're on-off. They ran up, they're on full power, and you control your speed and so on just by blipping the throttle. But as you say, you know, you'll get fuel being fed in and gumming up plugs and everything else.
Yeah.
I'd no idea it was such an elaborate control system.
The original rotaries were like that. They were just single lever, where you had a fuel control only. So the block tube was wide open.
Yeah.
But with that fuel control, you could adjust the RPM from around 1,000 to 1,050, make it lean and it'll drop off a little bit, make it rich and it'll drop off at the other end. But they found that that wasn't enough modulation to enable formation flying to be done, so the block tube lever was introduced, as well as the fuel air lever. And as the engines became more powerful, in the 130 horsepower Clerget manual, it said that it's not recommended to use the blip switch at all, because it puts too much of a shock on the engine, because it's quite a large rotary, quite a heavy rotary. So the early ones, with just a single lever, the 50 horse gnome, you could run it on a single lever from between 1,000 to 1,100 RPM quite happily. As you get into 110 horsepower, or the 80 horse Lerone and the 110 horse, sorry, the 80 horse gnome and the 110 Lerone, then they start to go into two-lever operation to get slightly more modulation to allow formation flying. And when you get up to the 130 Clerget, as well as the two-lever operation to allow the modulation, they're suggesting that you should prohibit using the blip switch to prevent shock loading the engine. So,
did they get as far as three-lever control in the First War?
Yes, the Blackburn has three-lever, and the Blackburn's 1912. Mm. The two levers operate the block tube and the mixture control. The third lever operates a rudimentary throttle. We don't trust it, so we leave it fully open all the time and then treat it as a two-lever, just using the block tube and the fine adjustment. But most of the Second World War airplanes, certainly all the Shuttleworth Second World War machines, the Bristol M1C, Sopwith Pup, Sopwith Camel, correction, Sopwith Pup, Sopwith Triplane, and Avro 504, First World War.
Yeah.
Did I say second? I meant
second.
First. But the four First World War rotaries have all got two-lever control, and they're mostly genuine machines or genuine reproductions.
And the only reason for inventing a rotary and going to all this trouble was to get sufficient cooling air around the heads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a solution to the cooling problem. Because they had stationary engines in those days. They had a green, I can't remember what the horsepower was. But there was, in fact, 35 horsepower green in the original Avro triplane, which I think was a four-cylinder in line. But there were some French motors that Blackburn used on some of his early monoplanes between 1912 and 1913, which were 5 and 7-cylinder radials, which were air-cooled. The Blériot has a 3-cylinder Anzani stationary engine, so they did exist. In fact, talking on throttles, the Blériot has got one of the most interesting ones for me. When I was in France doing the test pilot school, the one thing I learned is that everything is backwards in French. You know, they drive on the right, we drive on the left. We give priority to people on a roundabout when we go round it. They give priority to the people off the roundabout. When we say NATO, they say OTAN, which is the same letters back to front. And it's the same with the throttles, or the engine controls on the Blériot you have in the Shuttleworth collection. When you pull the lever that controls the engine power back, then the power increases, and when you push it forward, it decreases. And in fact, when the Hurricanes were pushed out of France at the beginning of the Second World War, they had to, I'm sure you're aware of all this, but they had to modify the airplanes to make the throttles work in the opposite sense. Yeah. Because that's the way the French throttle works.
On a French Jaguar, do you open the throttle by pulling it back?
No, not anymore. No. that was changed. That'd be too silly, because not now, but certainly in those days. In fact, the Blériot works off an advance and retard. Mm. There's no throttle at all. The advance and retard works the RPM, and you get, I don't know, probably about 500 to 1200 RPM, depending on the position of the advance and retard lever. But certainly, as you pull the lever back, you advance the ignition and the engine power increases. That's fun. Yeah.
Now, how do you find these? You've gone into a great description about First World War planes. I mean, what were they like as fighting machines, say, compared to the Jaguar? Can they be compared? So, going through, say, the Bristol Fighter, through to the Spitfire and the Gladiator, through to the Jaguar. Were they a lot harder to fight in?
Yes, they were, but the threat was different. Very difficult question to answer off the cuff. They were fighting their equivalent machines. The major problem, I would have thought, for those aircraft is the instability, in that to get a weapon solution on something, you've got to have a steady gun platform and a steady target to get a solution that's going to work. And with a Jaguar, that's relatively simple because it's a very stable airplane. The low gust factor. Some of these early First World War machines, some of the Second World War machines too, relatively light wing loading, unstable about one or two axes, bounce around the sky all over the place, and the people that they're trying to hit were doing the same. So it's an unpredictable target with an unpredictable gun platform. So to actually hit the target, yeah, I think it's much more difficult in the early machines than the modern ones. But everybody was in the same boat. The way they did it in those days was to sneak up behind, get underneath, and before they were spotted, just riddle them with bullets. And if you do that, it doesn't matter what your gun platform is, really. You could shoot down a Jaguar with a Sopwith Camel if it would go faster.
What about things like a roll rate on the Spitfire? Is it slower than a modern jet?
Yeah, much slower. Roll rate on the Spitfire is very slow, in fact.
Even on a 5B?
Yeah, with a clip wing. Yeah, the Hurricane's reasonable. The clip wing is probably about 1.5 times the rate of the curve wing, but the curve wing is very slow. But yes, very slow roll rate in the Spit. Very slow indeed. The major snag on the Spit is the torque, particularly on the Griffin versions. Whenever you change pitch on the airplane, it moves sideways.
Really?
So to try and get a firing solution is very difficult if you're in a situation where pitch is increasing, unless you're very good at coordinating with the rudders, which I suppose they would be in their day, because they get the practice.
Now, presumably the flying limitations are a lot more stringent on these old aeroplanes than they would have been in the actual day. I mean, you can't throw a Spitfire around the skies as they did in 1940. Or can you?
Well, you could.
I mean, what about their airframe life?
There's no life on a Spitfire airplane, airframe. In fact, there's no life on any of the old airplanes. We say to ourselves, we say jokingly, that fatigue hadn't been invented in those days, so it didn't exist. Although it obviously did. But the aircraft are made so strong that the fatigue life doesn't really come into it. We fly the aircraft all on condition, so they're inspected from time to time at regular intervals. And
both engine and airframe.
Both engine and airframe. And when they're broke, we mend it. The engines are always limited on hours between inspections. But the CAA has limited load factor on most of the aircraft, and also maximum speed. They limit maximum speed to 90% of that available during the war. And the load factor is normally limited to quite a low figure. On most of the historic aircraft, aerobatics are allowed. We have aerobatics approved at the moment on the Sopwith Pup, which was built in 1918 at Shuttleworth, and I think the wing spars are still original. So we can still do it, but we put our own limitations on most of the shuttleworth airplanes, that they will not be aerobatic, because we prefer them to be, they're there to be seen and heard, not as a medium by which the pilot can show off his skill. If he wants to do that, he goes off in a pit special and does it that way. The aircraft there are to be seen in their natural environment, but not turned upside down, so we don't normally do it, even though we could. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Or am I waffling?
No, it's interesting, because one reads certain things in aeroplane.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to get a closer up view of it. What about the Gladiator? The Shuttleworth have got one still, have they?
Yes, they have. Yes. How do you still flying that? Too. Delightful aeroplane. I was very surprised. My first flight in it, I was briefed to fly and given a piece of paper with all the limitations on. Got airborne from Old Warden and set the thing in a climb, and it was going up quite nicely with the engine power set to a reasonable figure. I throttled back a little bit just to ease the engine, because we don't run them at full power all the time. And just really for curiosity, I looked down at my knee pad to see what the climb speed and the engine RPM should be, and I looked at the speed and the engine RPM, and they were exactly there. It had happened naturally, and it really summed it up as an airplane that is very easy to fly and naturally goes to where it wants to go rather than you having to force it. Very few bad qualities. The only one is the biplane characteristic of not having a very good field of view. Biplanes are interesting to fly formation when you're side by side with another airplane, because as soon as you turn, you either lose him above your upper wing or you lose him below your lower wing, and when you go into the line of stern position, he's completely blank normally behind your upper wing, and all you can see is a tailplane sticking out the back and maybe a propeller occasionally sticking out the front. So biplane formation is quite interesting.
It's quite difficult. A new angle on the pre-war Hendon air displays.
Yes, it is. Lots of skill there.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of skill. But no, the Gladiator is a delightful airplane to fly. Handling quality is very, very good indeed. One or two major vices. It's very skittish on the ground, very prone to ground looping. So the pilot could be caught out quite badly on that. I can remember landing it at Duxford. Landing in a southwesterly direction during an air show and intending to turn to the right to clear the runway to the parking area, and the aircraft wanted to go to the left. I put right rudder on and it started going left, and I put right brake and it started going left, so I put lots of power on and it continued going left. So I said fine, and we went all the way around to the left and eventually ended up in the direction I wanted to be. The other fault is that of the engine. It's a Bristol Mercury engine, which is very prone to rich cut. If you do a slam acceleration, then the accelerator jet in the carburetor can put too much fuel in the engine and it'll stop. And also it'll cut when inverted. If you put negative G on it, it cuts, and it can take sometimes up to 30 seconds to get the engine back on an inverted rich cut. So you've got to be very careful not to put negative G on the airplane at low level. So we do not normally aerobat the airplane, even though it is cleared for aerobatics. But we've recently stripped and recovered it in Norwegian colours for a Norwegian film, but it will eventually go into British colours in a year or so's time, and discovered that the airframe is in excellent condition. We've had all the spars inspected with an endoscope, very long endoscope.
What's its history?
It was one of the last machines to come out of Gloucester's. It used to be the Gloucester demonstrator. It's always been a civilian aeroplane.
Never been used in anger.
No, and the then Gloucester chief test pilot, Dickie Martin, mm-hmm. when Gloucester's closed, arranged for it to be transferred to Shuttleworth Collection.
He's another one of my scalps, Dickie.
Yes. Yeah. I've never met him.
He's just up the road in Cheltenham.
Yeah, I've got it as on one of my list of things to do, and as you can see from my desk, I've got a lot of those at the moment. But it's on my do list to go up there with John Lewis to meet him and have a couple of ales and chew the fat one evening.
Very good. Any other Shuttleworth aircraft that we haven't talked about? I'm trying to think what they've got there. I haven't been to a display there.
Spitfire, Hurricane.
Yeah. I think we've covered that ground.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit.
There's one interesting one that I've flown recently, which is the English Electric Wren.
Yeah.
done for the limb trials, and that we have to catapult in the air to get it up. It's got a three horsepower ABC 398cc flat twin engine on the front, which is not much bigger than a model airplane engine, really. And the aircraft's a power glider, weighs about 300 pounds. With me on board, it almost doubles it. You know? And it's bungeed into the air, and we fly at the length of Old Warden. And it's interesting.
A bit of elastic. I mean, you know, it's more than just that, is it?
What? No, it's just a bungee. It's bungee the thing off, and away it goes.
It's got enough power, is it?
Yeah. It'll fly once it's up in the air. Yeah. It'll get airborne from Old Warden, but it takes most of the runway, and we don't want to circuit it, because the engine is a total loss oil system, which is controlled by the pilot. There's about a half a gallon of oil and a gallon of petrol just in front of the pilot. The oil system's pressurised by pulling out a plunger. The pilot then turns a small lever, for want of a better word, in the cockpit to adjust an oil flow rate, which goes through a J-tube in an inverted glass dome. It's only about half an inch by an inch and a quarter, something like that. Sits just in front of the pilot on the left-hand side on the combing. And the pilot observes the drips of oil coming through the J-tube and adjusts it to about one drip per second at idle and 1.5 drips per second at high power. And if you put too much oil in, it'll stop because it's oiled up. And if you put too little, it'll stop because it seizes. Mm-hmm. So the trick of flying the airplane is the management, pilot management of the oil system. And the pilot can't get the skill to run the oil system until he's done it. And we don't want him to fly a circuit until he's got the skill. So we're in a catch-22, and the result is that we don't circuit the airplane, we just hop it the length of the field. And the only way we can get it airborne to do that is by bungee.
Extraordinary.
There you go.
Can you tell me a bit more about your French test pilot training?
Yeah, that was at Istres, down in the south of France. Completely destroyed my Air Force career, because it's very much a civilian school, and it gets you into a civilian way of life, and then coming back into the real Royal Air Force after that is very, very difficult indeed. But it's great fun. They've got some super airplanes down there. We had Nord 262, Mistair Falcon, Mirage 3, prototype Cat 10, which is great fun because it's a little aerobatic trainer. Gliders, I didn't manage to fly those, but they were on previous courses. Alpha Jet, T-33, the American jet trainer. Alouette 2 and 3, another helicopter that escapes me. And aircraft that were brought in were the Mirage F1, the Super Etendard, what else? Mirage 2000 was going to be part of the course, but it wasn't. We ended up with the Epsilon instead. Fiat G222 and the Transall Caravelle and one or two others, so it turned out to be a very interesting year.
Yeah.
On the Fugger Magister too, that's a delightful little airplane to fly. Got some of the
French
nicest...
The French way of doing things, I mean, were they very strange to you? We've talked about throttle settings and things.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing was strange. I found that whenever anything got difficult, we always used to go and take lunch. And after that, nobody cared anyway. But in previous years, they used to have ground school in the morning and fly in the afternoon. And they found that foreign students couldn't cope. So when I was there, they'd switched it round and we flew in the morning. And then we'd go take lunch and then pour ourselves into ground school in the afternoon and sleep through it. You know? Because Frenchmen, lunch is an event to the French, and one has to have wine and just about everything else, whereas to the Englishman it's just a time of day and it just comes and goes as you please.
They didn't work you as hard as they would have done at the ETPS.
No, they didn't. The course is the same, but you do it as a team of four, so you get a quarter of the amount of work, and the qualification's the same when you come out the other end of it. So I got a good deal because I learned to speak French out of it, had an easy route through the course, and ended up with lots of different airplanes anyway, because you fly the English airplanes before you go as part of a refresher course. The only thing that I missed out on, if anything, was 6 months flying while I did a French course at Cranwell. But although it hurt at the time, the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages. And it's very useful in this job because we're pushing our engines into the Airbus at Toulouse. And it's interesting for the company to have somebody that speaks their language when you go into the meetings, because when they go into their little huddles and speak French, then I can report on the conversation afterwards.
Have you done any time on the Airbus at all?
No, I haven't. I represent Derby occasionally at the odd meeting. I've got one or two flights promised because I know the chief test pilot at Airbus. But the only flight I've done the Airbus was on 2P course, which was a familiarisation in the A300, looking at the flight instrumentation system, which was one of the first EFIS, electronic flight instrumentation system, aeroplanes.
And you haven't got onto the Eurofighter net yet?
No.
Are you likely to?
Not as a practicing pilot. I'll get a ride in it at some stage. Mm. But no, that's the only input we have is the engine, which is the EJ200. And the company's going very much on the lines of computer-designed engines have computer-designed test bedding. And provided the design is correct, it should go without testing. So they don't have test programs. They have demonstration programs just to make sure they work. They never do. But that's what it's aiming for. The only testing I get involved in the company is the empirical engines, where they haven't got the proper computer model for them.
Yeah.
Pegasus, Viper, Adder.
And you haven't flown any of the so-called control configuration vehicles then?
No, not at all.
I believe they modified a Jaguar for that, haven't they?
They did the fly-by-wire Jaguar.
Yes.
Some years ago, but no, I didn't fly that at all. The only fly-by-wire aircraft I've flown is the VSRA Harrier, yeah. NASA Ames in the States.
Fine. Well, I think that comes to the end of your story, unless you can think
that's
of anything.
It? No. Not in the world of general aviation, that's for sure.
How much? I mean, you said you keep current on the 125. I mean, how many hours do you get in a year at the moment?
We've got about 150 total.
Yeah.
About 50 of it in historic airplanes and about 100 on aircraft such as the 125 and the 146. It's not enough, but it's all I can get. Beggars can't be choosers. The historic stuff is. That's fun.
Yeah. Finally,
greatly satisfying.
Thank you very much indeed for talking
pleasure.
To me. It's of great historic value, actually, to have to be able to record someone who actually flies old aeroplanes, because they're fewer and further between to find now. Thanks very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.